Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Brad Ward, an agriculture technical consultant at ECHO, a faith-based development program. Brad also is a trained permaculture practitioner, receiving his permaculture design certificate from Andrew Millison and Marisha Auerbach in 2012 through the online program at Oregon State University. Brad came to my attention on a recommendation by Eric Tonesmeyer, originally as a possible guest for the Faith and Earth Care series, but in setting up the interview with Brad, he and I spoke quite extensively about development aid and how permaculture can be used to ask better questions. In turn, that allows us to reform our efforts to meet people where they're at. That forms the basis of our conversation today. Along the way, we also touch on the personal struggles and transformation that comes from wanting to aid others in a meaningful way. As with the conversation with Rachel Kaplan, there's a lot of internal work to bring change out into the world. Whether you have an interest in international development or not, quite a bit of this conversation applies equally to our internal landscape, as well as the business of permaculture. Asking the right questions, those that are relevant to ourselves and our customers, and being able to step out of our normal frame of reference, changes the quality of our practices. Listen to this interview with Brad and let me know what you think, and how I might assist you on your path. If there is a way for me to help you, give me a call, 717-827-6266, or send an email, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. Before we begin, I have two quick things. First, the show is on the road. I'll be at ChabaCon October 11th, 2014, in Bridgeton, New Jersey. Come out and join me for a day, starting with a run in the park with Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute, who is also the keynote speaker, and conversations about how to create a better world. Then in the afternoon, there's a bus tour of local sites working on sustainability, as well as street theater, art, music, and other community events. From there, October 20th through the 22nd, I'll be in Roanoke, Virginia, touring farms and interviewing. Tuesday, October 21st, as part of that visit, I'll be at the Roanoke Natural Foods Co-op in the evening, that's the site at Grandin Village, for a lecture on permaculture, creating a better world by design, and I'd love to see you there. October also starts the fall fundraising campaign to cover the expenses of running the podcast. That includes things like renting server space, equipment repairs and upgrades, hiring photographer John and Lane to take pictures and help cover events, as well as a salary for me, your host. If you are in a place to make a financial contribution to the show, please do so by going to www.thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Any amount helps and is greatly appreciated. Now then, on to Brad Ward. Then Brad, Mr. Ward, if you're ready, could you give us a bit of your biography and background, how you came to do what you're doing? And then we'll move into the conversation of integrating permaculture into your work as a member of an NGO.
Sure. I guess probably the best place to start is in the present, maybe, and work backward. I currently work for ECHO, which is in Fort Myers, Florida, and ECHO is a nonprofit organization, and our mission is addressing hunger and providing options and solutions for smallholder farmers and the people that serve them. I've been with ECHO for just about 2 years, and before coming to ECHO, I spent several years in Honduras and a year also in Costa Rica working in agriculture development work and in a couple different settings there. And before that, I lived in Oregon, was raised in Oregon, and I grew up there, involved with raising sheep and around hazelnut filbert orchards. Kind of my career history is all over the place, but it's always been tied to the land in one way or another, except for a brief stint in the Coast Guard when my life was tied to the sea. But I bring a varied background, including a background in finance. That's originally what brought me to Central America, was to work in projects that were involved in microfinance and credit. And those projects were not sufficiently developed at that point to need those services, and instead still needed some basic agriculture extension services, which kind of led my career path in a direction that I hadn't planned, but I'm very grateful for. And it was in the delivery of those services in a new setting, in a new context, that I began to question and wonder about the experience and education that I had, which was in conventional agriculture. And as I investigated and learned more about smallholder agriculture, the issues facing it, the issues facing our own country's agriculture system, I was introduced to permaculture. And that was probably, 6 years, maybe 5 years ago, that I first became aware of permaculture and began to investigate it. I saw that it offered some really, really excellent tools and excellent ways of thinking about solving problems. And so I embraced it pretty fully and learned kind of on my own, which many people do for a while. And then a couple years ago, I had the opportunity to take my permaculture design course through Oregon State University and Andrew Millison. And he did an excellent job helping me understand better how to bring all of these principles under one roof, and a good way to sort out the projects that I was tasked with designing through some of my work here at ECHO. That's kind of my journey from past to present, especially with regards to permaculture.
Well, we have an instructor in common. Andrew Millison was one of the co-instructors for my permaculture teacher training. So, and that was in Oregon with him and Jude Hobbs and Rico Zook back in 2011.
Oh, that's great. Let's see, I guess it would have been 2012 that I did my PDC.
And then did you also have Marisha Auerbach?
Yes, Marisha was a co-instructor for that.
I've interviewed both of them in the past, and I like them both very much.
They were excellent, excellent instructors. And the delivery of that course was a distance course, which I've had the opportunity to be in some face-to-face courses now as they come and use ECHO's campus for usually a weekend of their training. And, you know, that's a great method, but I thought Andrew and Marisha just did as good a job as possible as bringing the community together that was in that course and, you know, even working at a distance. It was super valuable.
In starting this conversation when I first contacted you, because Eric Tonesmeyer put the two of us in touch, part of our conversation was about continuing the discussion about faith and earth care, particularly through outreach. And I'd like to move into that, but before we get there, I would like to make it clear that the conversation that we're having today is between me, Scott Mann of the Permaculture Podcast, and you, Brad Ward, as Brad Ward, not as a representative or member of ECHO in this conversation.
That's correct.
I know how tangled that can get sometimes, and I just wanted to make that clear.
Perfect.
Awesome. So then, would you like to share with us some of the things that you've learned practicing permaculture as a member of a non-governmental organization?
Yeah, and I guess what I first want to say is that probably this conversation will lead to talking about some things in a critical sort of way, but I hope that when we talk about things critically, that it isn't all the negative parts of what we think about when we say the word criticism, but it includes just earnestly trying to find where we're maybe not doing things as well as we can and where we can do them better. And it's in that spirit, because the truth is the people that I know that are working so hard, particularly, I mean, I know people working in development all over the world by virtue of my job here at ECHO, but my personal experience is in Latin America, Central America in particular. And without exception, these people are good, good people with great intentions and who have really laid a lot on the line to serve the people that they're serving. And so I want to couch all of what we talk about here under that heading, which is these are good people and people doing good things. I don't mean that to sound ominous about what's coming, but I think the truth is that as I got immersed in doing development work in Latin America and began to look around at the small villages and communities where we lived and worked, and began to get the scope of history of development work that had been going on in Honduras, you know, in the modern sense, had been going on since the Peace Corps first arrived there. Well, really before that, but this smallholder development kind of work has been going on for 40 plus years, almost 50 years in that country in particular, where most of my experience is. And so you look around and you say, with the amount of energy that's been exerted, the amount of good-hearted people that have been working, the diligent and hard efforts of the people who were being developed, for lack of a better term, their commitment to various projects, their blood, sweat, and tears that were invested. What is it that we're seeing? Why are we not seeing real transformation? Why are we not observing lives that are not just better fed, better educated, et cetera, but lives that are more just, systems that are working better, resilience against the natural disasters or just normal events that come through life. Why are we not seeing that? Why can't we look back 10 or 20 years and see real progress made? We can see some things that let us check the boxes of progress off. For example, we might be in a village that has electricity that didn't have electricity 8 years ago. We might be in a village that now has a road that leads from the village down to the main highway, and before it was, you know, just a horse trail. We might be in a village that, you know, has an elementary school that didn't have a building for that 10 years ago. And all these things point to progress. But when you are living there and immersed in that and looking for, you know, the results of those outputs leading to, you know, just lives that are safer and lives that are more dignified, et cetera, you're not necessarily seeing that output. And so I was there working along in the context of an NGO that was faith-based but not tied to any particular denomination, just Christian faith-based, and had a lot of both secular and faith-based employees. And its programs were completely surrounded around agriculture issues, in particular helping subsistence farmers be able to produce vegetables that could be then sold in the major markets. And, you know, the monies for these kinds of projects came from donors outside of the donors from the United States that were interested in seeing development. Some of the monies came from grants that came from the direct beneficiaries of these vegetables being grown, the middlemen, as it were, in that supply chain of vegetables. So in doing that project and seeing the fits of starting and stopping and just, again, seeing it as, boy, this is another project that's being done, almost seeing what I began to call this game of development chicken happening, which development chicken to me is where people that have been receiving development aid in one way or another begin to realize, especially if they're in an area where there's a lot of practitioners practicing. In the small village that I worked in, which was a municipality of about 4,000 people and was the kind of the center point of a population of about 40 or 50,000 people living in really small villages around it. Pretty much every major international aid agency had either an office in this town or had a regular presence by way of its agents being in that town. Almost all of them had services being regularly delivered there. And what I began to notice was that folks in our project would begin to sometimes stall or resist moving forward with the project. And what we would come to find out is that other NGOs that were working there would be offering maybe a sweeter deal. Many times our projects between the NGOs were on very, very parallel paths. And so it might just be an input. It might be sometimes just better lunch at one of the training meetings that would sway people over to considering this other project. At any rate, what people would then do is begin to understand that they could begin to hold out and force the NGOs to begin to up the ante of inputs or of services or what have you to get a better deal down the line. And it was just troubling to see, not because people were holding out on our project. The point, that was just the symptom of what I saw underlying was, you know, something that was very troubling. So it made me begin to question just the way that development was being done in the first place. And, you know, particularly as a person of faith, wanting to see people really transform their lives, this became more and more troubling. And so as I began to analyze what was going on, one of the things that I began to see, and I think this is when, you know, probably permaculture first came into my horizon of view, was that the mechanisms that were pushing development were really at their base not about helping people become, you know, people enjoy dignified lives on their land, in their context, in their really with much of their input about what actually made a good and dignified life. Now, I realize people don't live in a vacuum, that once all the mechanisms of modern media come to a place, that begins to redefine what the good life is, what a dignified life is, what should be. But at the same time, especially when development aid is coming from a mindset that is very consumer driven and very, you know, globalized market driven, what you have is that as becomes the desired output. And so all of the pressures become lined up with bringing that desired output about. By that, I mean, I guess, frankly, that folks will become better consumers, that they'll have a life that allows them more choices. And that's the good side of that coin. But those choices often, from a development point of view, are driven around the choice to have more things, buy more things. And it doesn't necessarily start with the idea that people, especially, for example, people living in the tropical region that gets good regular rainfall, has good soil, is a great growing climate, that the abundance in those areas that's endemic to those areas, that needs to be the thing that's celebrated and developed towards, rather than, you know, a desire for lots and lots of things that are outside of that area. So that's kind of what got me wondering in the first place. Is there a better way to do development? And does the first step for that better way start with even questioning what our aim is as developers? And if we can't get past the point of trying to create, in essence, this vision of urban, suburban, consumer, mall-driven world, if ultimately that's the world that we're comfortable with, and if ultimately we view that as the goal of development, I guess to say, if we don't live in a developing country here in the United States, if we view ourselves as fully developed or, you know, way up on the development chain, if we look at Western Europe the same way, if this is the purpose of development, is that in and of itself a good goal? And then when I back up the bus a little bit farther and I look at the fact that in many ways, especially the faith culture that I come from, looks at the United States, looks at the way we've developed as ordained by God, looks at, you know, still carries in its pockets a lot of the coinage of manifest destiny. If we look at our world as the one that our faith tells us should exist, then of course we're taking that and overlaying that into the rest of the world. And I guess where I ran up into big problems was just realizing that even for my own activities, and probably starting with my own activities and still continuing to look at my own activities, the world simply cannot sustain that. The ecosystems do not afford the population of this planet living the way we do. And that is a fundamental flaw in trying to drive everything in that direction with development.
Was that a rather sobering realization?
Well, absolutely. I'll tell you what was sobering about that was it was personally sobering. This journey, you know, I've talked a lot about the them so far, but the truth is, you know, most of the transformation that I can point to that's going on is going on in my own life over the last 4 or 5 years. And that's really looking at myself as a sharer of this ecosystem that we live in and as a steward of it. It's like when you're a kid and you go camping. And your dad says, you know, when you're cleaning up and getting ready to go home from your camping trip, your dad says, all right, let's patrol the campground and let's make sure we leave this place better than we found it. And so not only do you, you know, make sure your fire is completely out and not only that, you know, your little campsite is good, but you go, you know, another 50 yards out in diameter around your campsite. You pick up a little bit of somebody else's trash. And hopefully when you leave the woods, you've left it in a better state than you found it. And, you know, I think that's an example of the way I see stewardship working out. It's not just a matter of doing no harm. It's making things better, hopefully. We have this resource. And, you know, my faith gives me some direction as to whose that resource is. And it's not just mine to spend. It's God's to steward. And I need to leave this campsite not just as nice as I found it, but hopefully the area around it better as well. And so, you know, these questions began to seep into my own life. You know, the point wasn't so much, gee, these small hill scale farmers just aren't going in the right direction. It's, gee, Brad, you are a big part of the reason why. And, you know, it starts with the fact that you've never taken 3 seconds to look at your own worldview and consider that maybe the world isn't supposed to look like rural suburban Oregon. You know, maybe all of that world, maybe that isn't the highest aim for the way the world's supposed to look. And maybe the things that you're doing, the things that you're consuming, the ways that you vote with your dollars are a big part of that problem. And so, yes, that was very sobering, because it's a lot easier to look at the mess other people are making rather than to potentially look at the mess you're making or being part of.
When did you begin this personal examination, and how has it changed your life and the work that you do? If that's not too big of a question.
You know, it's a good question. Yeah, probably if I trace it all the way back, it began in the mid-90s when my wife and I began to go on what is now a rite of passage for evangelicals, which is a short-term mission trip somewhere into the third world. And we went to Mexico and dug lines for a water system in a small village. And, you know, it was my first brush with the reality of life for people living outside of the Western world. And for the next 8 years or so, that became kind of our annual pilgrimage of, you know, I don't know, pilgrimage of what, but our annual pilgrimage. And that led us to the place of wanting to question our own careers and our own trajectory, and seek to find something that was maybe more purposeful, more fulfilling. But see, that's all still aimed at my own betterment, as it were. That's still very, very self-focused. It wasn't until we really got to Latin America. We spent a year in Costa Rica learning how to function in Spanish, and then moved on to Honduras after that. And probably it wasn't for another year that I really began to. And, you know, that doesn't happen in a vacuum. That happens because there were people around me, other development workers, people that were speaking into my life in this new context where I had to accept a bigger story than I had accepted up to that point. A bigger story about what's good, a bigger story about what's possible, all these things. When you let yourself be in a different place and you really begin to open your eyes and your heart to that place, your story gets bigger, and hopefully, and for me for sure, you know, the answers to the questions thus far in my life were not working anymore. The traditional answers of a pretty straight down the middle America conservative way of looking at the world and looking at faith and looking at what's good and what's not good and what's poverty and what's not poverty. You know, there were a lot of formational things. Again, got introduced to good books like Walking with the Poor by Bryant Myers, you know, reading One Straw Revolution, which was really my first introduction. I think when I first read One Straw Revolution, I hadn't yet really heard the term permaculture. If I had, it kind of bounced off and I hadn't really thought about what it was. So, you know, if you're in the middle of this agriculture development work and you read One Straw Revolution and your mind is open, your world is going to fall off a cliff because the information that the thesis, you know, provided in that writing, that's a whole different set of answers to the questions. And, you know, for me, that was a real, wow, I need to back this bus up a lot because I don't even think I'm asking the right questions. And I think the way I'm asking questions, I'm asking them because I want the answer to fit inside this box, if that makes sense. I'm trying to think of a good example of that because I know that's a very vague way of saying it. But let's just say, for example, you know, I'm asking the question, how can a subsistence farmer begin to create an income on the small piece of land that he holds so that rather than just providing, hopefully, for the basic needs of his family, he's also generating enough of an income to absorb emergencies, to allow for his children all to go to school rather than picking a few this year and a few next year and et cetera, et cetera. You know, that sounds like the right question to ask, but is it the right question to ask? I mean, is income generation the right thing always? In our economy, absolutely. But is that the only way that the world works? And I'm not saying that the answer to that is no. I'm not trying to say that income generation is a bad thing. The truth is, Central America is part of the globalized economy. There's no escaping that, no matter how far down the dirt road you go. There are implications to continuing to broaden that base of income generation, continuing to broaden the reality of globalized economy. And it ignores, in lots and lots of ways, the very powerful survival strategies that brought people thus far to this place. And it also ignores the fact that in many, many, many cases, the way that people were, what we would say, surviving, might have actually been in many ways thriving. And if we look at the ecosystems around them, potentially those ecosystems were thriving as well. It's because we don't even ask the question far enough back. You know, it's easy for us to look at slash and burn agriculture, which is one of the real eco-harmers in Central America. And so much of development work is now about fixing that. Where did that come from in the first place? Well, that wasn't an indigenous system. And if it was, it was done very, very differently that allowed the kind of rest periods that land needed to recover from that. So anyway, you know, the simple fact that, for example, and, you know, Eric Tonesmeyer and many others have been integral in informing my views on this, which is, in a tropical setting, the opportunity to essentially graze, for lack of a better term,
to forage?
Yeah, that's the word. Thank you. The ability to forage for a great deal of your nutrition, if not a great deal of your calories, is present in many, many of these ecosystems. And if you back the bus up far enough, that was the predominant way of living. You know, there were calorie crops that were grown, and there was a great deal of calories and certainly a great deal of nutrition that was being foraged. And so why was it important to change from that mechanism to the current one that we now, especially as development agents, promote so heavily? I don't know of very many development agencies, but there are some that promote heavily a foraging first approach. And that would be one of the ways where for me, learning about permaculture was a gigantic aha moment of, wow, why is it that foraging isn't even on my list as a development person as a possible solution to the lack of nutrition or lack of calories in people's lives? Why is it that a more intensive, annualized, and technologically advanced way of producing food is the first thing on my list? So, you know, you roll back and say, why am I asking the questions the way I ask them? And that really was, you know, that shift. And then, of course, then you have to point that cannon at yourself and say, why is it okay for me to drive as much as I drive? Why is it okay for me to, when I know better, continue to buy the $5 t-shirt when I know that $5 does not produce a t-shirt that is just all the way down the line? Why is it okay? All those questions begin to come into your life. You know, even this week, one of the great things about being at Echo is that we have people constantly coming through Echo, either to give us some training or just to be on the farm and do some learning on their own. This week we had an individual here, and a lot of his work has revolved around essentially calorie banking. And I don't want to get too technical here, but again, it was one of these things that opened my eyes to a new question that I wasn't asking. And that is, as simply as I can state it, let's just say, we'll use the UN 2000 calorie a day number. Why is it that the people that are making all the decisions about food growing, why are they? You can divide people into two categories in the world if you want to along this line, which is, there's a bunch of people in the world that are struggling to get up to 2,000 calories, and there's a bunch of people in the world that are struggling to get down to 2,000 calories. All right? So why is it that the people who are making the decisions for the people struggling to get up to the 2,000 calories are all the people that are struggling to get down to it. Do you see what I'm trying to say there, which is I've never walked in the shoes of a person struggling to get to 2,000 calories. And I might ask a whole different set of questions if I was him than I do as a person who's struggling to get down to that healthy amount of calories in my diet. And not only that, but I might come up with solutions that just assume that there's always calories to burn, rather than understanding that for every hour of agricultural work that somebody has to do, that adds another 230 calories to their need. You know, if they do 4 hours of work, they're no longer at 2,000 calories, they're closer to 3,000 calories of need. And if their family only has a bank of 2,000 calories per person, then somebody's going to have to give up those calories for the worker. And most of the time, that's going to be a very vulnerable person in that situation.
Because that's going to be a child or the elderly?
Exactly. And so these are the kinds of things that you miss. How often do you think about that thing as a person who's fighting to get down to 2,000 calories so you don't have to go buy another pair of pants, right? These are the things that I still learn really on a weekly basis that shift and mold my way of. In all of that, permaculture came along with a way to begin to reframe these questions. Because the thing that's lovely about permaculture in my mind is not only is it this set of tools, these principles, but it's this set of ethics that underlie them. And if every time you approach a problem, and instead of immediately doing what I tend to do and most people that I know are hired to be problem solvers tend to do, which is to apply your various tools to that problem, you know, what if the first thing you do is begin to think about the ethics that are underlying the tools that you bring into that situation? What is it that I can do that is actively caring for people? What is it that I can actively do here that is better stewarding creation? What is it that I can actively do here that helps create more abundance for people to share? And from a Western development point of view, we would like to say that that's how we come and approach things. But often what our donors are looking for, and ultimately we would like to point the finger at them and say that it's their fault because they're putting their pressures on us. But it still comes back to, you know, when it really comes down to it, I forgot that poverty doesn't look necessarily like I think it does. And that also the other side of that coin, that people that are developed, I may be able to check most of the boxes in a modern scenario of poverty and find people that are very well developed. I'll give just a quick example of that. One of my mantras once I learned about permaculture was to try and always overlay whenever I was in a new situation, to try and look around and observe, or at least think through, what is it that I'm being asked to bring that didn't exist 150, 100 years ago. By that, I mean, we took a checklist into any developing country village. On that checklist, we would have many, many items: education systems, electricity, sanitation, running water, adequate housing, adequate nutrition and calories. There's some of those things in that list that have always existed since recorded history started. You know, people that don't have adequate calories or nutrition, they've always at some, you know, had poverty at some level. Those are people that no matter how far back we go in the history, that was a way to define poverty. But electricity, modern education, and I know these will sound heretical, but housing that mirrors a Western style of housing, modern medicine, you know, I wouldn't want to deprive my children modern medicine, but is a lack of that a way to measure poverty when until 100 years ago, and really for most cases 50 years ago, modern medicine didn't exist? You know, people had healthcare systems that were functioning at some level, you know, well before modern medicine came. And granted, there was a lot of things that happened to people in their health that don't have to happen now. And I'm not talking about depriving people of that. That would be wrong at every level that you can imagine. But at the same time, why do we walk into a village and one of the first things we want to do is, instead of looking around at at the ways that they've been managing their health and trying to work with that system. Why do we want to instantly overlay a new system in that? And every time we do that, that creates tension and stress, because there's no place you can walk into, for the most part, that doesn't have a system of healthcare in existence. There's somebody in that village that is the healthcare provider, and there are medicines or there are practices, and we may look at them as very superstitious, but there is a practice going on for healthcare, and there are healthcare practitioners everywhere you go. And to immediately want to overlay a new system in that, good, better, indifferent, means that we're not even starting, I think, from the right point of questions. So anyway, I say all that, and I realize it's heretical, but I say all that to say one of the things I used to like to do was I was friends with a family, and they lived way, way up on this hill. And it was literally a 3-hour uphill walk with about a 10 minutes of flat in that 3 hours of uphill. It was really strenuous to get up there. And so when I would have visitors come that could handle the walk, we would go up and spend the day with that family. You know, it was an intact family in the sense that the whole family unit was there, dad, mom, all the kids. It was, you know, their setting. Almost all the boxes that you'd want to check for development were not checked. They had, you know, they didn't have a concrete floor. They didn't have a metal roof. There was no school nearby. There was water in a stream, so they had a fresh water source, et cetera, et cetera. My point is, when we would walk back down the hill, I would always ask, after about a half hour of walking, I would always ask my guests, were we with poor people today? And I never had one person answer that question, yes, we were with poor people. And yet, as a development worker, in almost every way that you would measure poverty, they matched up to that measurement. And so I think in a lot of ways, we ask the wrong questions, because we're with people for a day or even months at a time, like I was with this family. And we realize that they're not suffering from poverty the way that we define it. And there's tons of things that they'd like to change about their life, just like the rest of us. But those might not be the things that we want to change about their life. And quite frankly, if we could help them, you know, begin to take better advantage of the resources that are around them, if we can be people that shine the light on really the abundance and blessing that's already in their life, we'd be doing a lot more to help them celebrate the dignity and blessings of their life than we do when we bring a whole list of problems that need to be solved.
It reframes the conversation from one of scarcity to one of abundance.
That's exactly right.
I've received feedback from people about how permaculture has changed their lives because it takes away the fear because of what they're able to build and what they're capable of doing within their own goals and their own needs. That it removes this framework of judging against what do my neighbors have or what else is out there in the world. And in looking for that abundance that is around us, we can worry about whether or not the person next to us has enough in their bowl, rather than worrying about whether or not they have more than us.
Exactly. You know, what you just said resonates a lot with me, because the truth is, a Western way of looking at the world and all of the mechanisms that create the Western worldview, as I see it, are built towards not being satisfied with what you have. We have a gigantic multi-billion dollar machine pointed directly at us, and it is extremely effective. And we let it into our lives. And what that machine says to us literally hundreds of times a day, if not thousands, is you're missing something. And it might be that you're missing a toy. It might be that you're missing the good looks that you deserve. It might be you're missing, you know, a joyful recreational time with your family. And, you know, unfortunately, our faith systems are not divorced from those mechanisms. And they often use those same tools in the same way to make us feel like we're missing something and that what we are is not good enough, or et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, we can't help but bring that wherever we go, because it is just in our bones to feel deprived, even though in human history, we are the least deprived people ever, ever, ever. And so we look at other people's bowls to see if they've got more in them than we do. That is our default way of looking at the world. And that's our default way, unfortunately, of bringing development. And it's not that we ever say that in our grant proposals. It's never in our purpose statements. It's not truly in our hearts, but it frames every question that we ask. And what happens is, that I think is a disease, by the way. And unfortunately, it's an infectious disease. And we're carriers of it to a large extent into places that don't have it. Our favorite way to carry it is on a power line. And then, you know, the TV gets plugged in and all bets are off. So, yes, when you can begin to see the world from a sense of abundance, when you can begin to appreciate in your own life how much you have and how much you don't need and how much that's there in your world that you can discover that's yours. And, you know, that idea of abundance to me is that there's all this stuff in my world that's available to me that I haven't even discovered yet. From a natural world point of view, how many edible plants are there out there that I could forage that I haven't discovered yet? How many places can I go see that are just within walking distance or a short bicycle ride from my house that will bring me tons of joy? How many experiences can I have with my children and my wife and my close friends in our household together, sharing laughter and sharing stories that I haven't experienced because I'm constantly being told, you know, to go satisfy that Jones for entertainment outside? How much does the overlay of my overly busy, stressful 500 emails to answer life cause me to just have to go get the Novocaine of mindless entertainment, when if I just didn't have that in my life, I wouldn't be jonesing for that mindless entertainment in the first place? One of my biggest fears for our family and personally moving back from living in Honduras into living in Florida was that the Pandora's box of these messages was going to be opened back up into my life. Yeah, you asked earlier on in this interview, you know, where this change began to happen. And this is an important story to tell that's tied to that. When we first went to Costa Rica and we were in language school, and I didn't have enough language skill to really function. And so we'd been there about a month, and I woke up one morning and I was feeling particularly light in my spirit. And I was like, what is this? You know, school was really hard. Cramming a new language into a 40-year-old's brain is a difficult exercise. At least it is for my brain. And so I was like, wow, I'm just feeling such a lightness of spirit today. You know, what is that about? And I was kind of reflecting on that. And I just, you know, had one of those epiphanies that lightness was there because all the messages that are aimed at me to manipulate me and make me feel bad about myself or to want something that I don't have were unable to penetrate because they were in a language I didn't understand. And so even though I was living in the middle of San Jose, Costa Rica, a big city, none of these consumer messages were penetrating. You know, and even after 30 days of kind of being outside of that influence, it was like, holy smokes, it was a Matrix-like experience for me. I realized for the rest of the time that we lived in Latin America, which is about 7 years, I realized what a blessing that was, that when I was there, even though, you know, I understood Spanish enough to understand advertising, but we lived far enough off the ground that most of the time it didn't enter our lives. What a privilege it was to be outside of the pressure that puts on us subconsciously. And one of the greatest fears I had coming back to this world was, holy smokes, I'm going to be coming back to a place where I've got to deal with that. Even though I recognize it, I don't think that I think it's more powerful than any of the mechanisms I have to defend against it. And in a lot of ways, I have to tell you, Scott, it has been true that has seeped back into my life. And the other thing that seeped back into my life was, you know, this artificial busyness that controls us. I love the work I do, and I love being a productive person, and I find so much purpose in this. But by definition of being an American, more is expected and asked then can be delivered in a way that doesn't create almost a frantic effort. And I don't mean that, you know, my employer is putting that load on me. I just mean the burdens of Western life, the things that I need to take my kids to, the meetings that I need to attend, the emails that I have to answer, the responsibilities I have, the other opportunities that I better take advantage of. Boy, when you try and fit those into life, there's just no space left. So, I mean, I guess that's a little bit of a tangent, but I think it does get to the heart of the matter of why in the world would I want to bring that to anybody else in the world? Why would I want to lay that burden on somebody else's lap? To me, that's, you know, that's the exact opposite of development. If development is truly about bringing people to a sense of sufficiency, abundance, dignity, peace, the Western world is not a very good picture of those things. And so we need to ask a different set of questions.
And in asking that different set of questions, we need to meet people where they're at, rather than imposing ourselves and our views upon them.
Yeah, and maybe even begin to, when we meet those people where they're at, wonder how our meeting with them helps transform our lives. I mean, the point of these engagements is that we both, as human beings, bring something to each other that helps us both be better. That's the, hopefully, the point of these engagements. But so often, we enter the development sphere as people who don't need to be developed, right? I don't even like the word developing world, because what it does is it makes this assumption that this whole part of the world needs to be developed and this other part of the world doesn't. The whole world is the developing world. It's a real mistake to assume that the developed world, quote unquote, doesn't need development from the developing world. In other words, doesn't need to begin to learn tons of lessons. I think the fact is, and this is just my own philosophy, very soon the developed world doesn't begin to understand the lessons of living sufficiently in a world that doesn't have all the development boxes checked. You know, I fear very much for how much runway we have left to use the resources that we use, that are without them, we would immediately scream poverty and lack of development. I very much think that it could be that development practitioners 50 years from now are people coming from what we now call the developed world that have mechanisms of survival and tenacity and resilience that they'll bringing into our completely collapsed systems. And I'm not a doomsdayer. I'm not a person who has a bunker. I'm a hopeful person. But if we ignore the physical realities of our ecosystem forever, we will need development agents to come teach us how to live. And we will become the developing world. And so I think that's something for us to internalize and say, what if, you know, we don't have to make that choice. We can search for that softer landing. And I think it goes also with the development projects that we've already brought. You know, we're already engaged in lots and lots of activities that, quite frankly, when we have our closed door meetings as development agents, we know most likely will go all wrong, but our donors, we're down the path with our donors and we don't have a choice. And so we were talking about this just a few weeks ago, about this idea of helping donors revision a soft landing for their bad projects. That would be a good first step for us to understand, oh my goodness, the end result of this is going to be a crash, and it doesn't have to be. It might be a crash landing, but it can at least be a soft landing. It doesn't have to be a crash. And that's hard to do when you've already spent a lot of money and put in a lot of infrastructure. That's hard to do. But the difficulty of that, it shouldn't be our pride that makes us continue to crash the plane just because we've decided to do that. You know, at some point, just like gravity, we have to recognize the physical laws of our ecosystem and decide that just like gravity, they are going to be obeyed, those laws. And we can provide a lot of force to defy gravity, but if we ever stop, you know, applying that force, gravity wins. And it's the same with the ecosystem. We can apply right now a lot of force to defy it, but at some point we run out of the thing that makes that force happen, the fuel for it.
There's a lot here that I would like to visit again and discuss with you in more depth in the future. But for this time that we've had together so far today, do you have any last thoughts for the listeners before we draw this particular conversation to a close?
Well, I guess my last thoughts, again, are hopeful ones. Again, we've kind of had a conversation about things that are wrong, but there's a ton that's right too. And I think one of the things that gives me more hope than anything else is that in the developing world that I live in, permaculture is beginning to creep out of the shadows of something that is very, very, a very, very niche thing, and is beginning to come into many, many broader conversations. I think that's a really, really good thing, because as permaculture begins to have a voice in development and begins to be one of the frameworks that development workers would use, I believe that it will broaden the way we ask questions, broaden what we think is a good answer to that question. And I'm glad to be a part of that and wish that it would have come into my life much sooner. But it's like that statement about planting a tree, right? The best day to take your PDC course is 20 years ago, and the second best day is tomorrow, right? Or today.
I really appreciate that sentiment. And knowing that permaculture is growing as a way to meet the needs of others in a way that is meaningful for them in the place where they find themselves, and that for those of us who have that education and that knowledge, that there is a place for us that can assist that process as equals on the path and to provide leadership so that others can surpass us in the future.
It's been a great pleasure. I appreciate it.
And that was Brad Ward. Two things that stand out from this conversation were Brad's reference to Pandora's box. One of the things I've been thinking about lately is that myth, and remembering that there was something left in the box after all the evils of the world were released. And that was Elpis, the spirit of hope. Though hope wasn't released, I don't see that as a negative side of the story, but instead that each of us carry hope, Elpis, inside of us. I know I do with me every day. I'm an optimistic person by nature and see the future as bright and abundant, but that we have to take the path seriously and work towards it. Something I've said to a friend of mine recently is that we create our own luck. But myself, people like Brad, each and every one of you who listens to this show, we together are all part of creating that abundant future. I'm here with hope in abundance to help you on your path. Together, we can do this. The other piece that comes to mind was about the artificial busyness of life, packing our schedule and always having something to do. This is something that came up when I interviewed Brad Lancaster, and that conversation will be out later in the year. And he asked me to do a show on how I live a full life with so many things going on and all the different roles that I fill between being a podcaster, a parent, a graduate student, a friend, journalist, swordsman, magician, all these other things that I do in life. A big part of living such a full life is overcoming the distractions. I let go of the mindless, brain-numbing entertainment that Brad Ward mentioned. I disconnected from advertisements. It took a lot of work, and there are still times I catch myself consuming media kind of mindlessly, but when I do notice that that's happening, I put it down and move to something of value, something that means something to me. With that, I continue to use permaculture to design the way I live my life so that I live with intent. Nearly everything I do is a conscious choice. With that comes an acceptance of what matters and what needs to get done or can be left for later. There's something beautiful about spending an evening with my children and being completely present in that moment and in their lives and not worrying about what I have to do next. To see a friend and ask them, "How are you doing?" and to mean that question. To create a space to listen and really hear what they have to say rather than asking that question to fill the space until I can speak again. In doing this, I found that my life becomes more and more my own. I don't worry about the past because there's nothing that I can do to change it. I don't ask what-if questions about the future, but instead live more and more in the moment. That allows me, as Mark Lakeman spoke to some time ago, to inhabit my own story. That doesn't necessarily give you a path to get to a place where you can get rid of all this artificial busyness. It's a big picture kind of approach of what it's like to let go of that. But I'll put together something here in the near future that goes through my process of getting to this point, so you have something more practical to use in your own life. If you've gone through this path and taken these kinds of steps to live a life of intent, and you'd like to share some of your ideas with me or the listeners, definitely get in touch. I'd like to hear how you're living your life in this way. Again, email show@thepermaculturepodcast.com or give me a call, 717-827-6266. And while you're at it, if you want to, you can also follow the show on Twitter @permaculturecst or like the show on Facebook and join in the conversations there, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast. From here, next week's interview is with Ethan Rowland of Appleseed Permaculture to discuss the 8 forms of capital and regenerative enterprise. The following week, on October 22nd, is the third and final piece with Mark Shepard on restoration agriculture. Again, we use the framework of listener questions in order to discuss that topic. The world truly is a beautiful and abundant place. Let us be stewards of a bountiful future by taking care of Earth, ourselves, and each other.